Your student loan payment is $10 a month. Your instinct is to throw every dollar you have at the balance anyway. And that instinct is going to cost you real money. Keep listening as we dive in. Welcome to the Money Meets Medicine podcast, where we talk all about the personal finance topics you wish you had learned in medical school. I'm your host, Justin Harvey, and here is your co-host, who just got back from his first trip to the Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown, Dr. Jimmy Turner.
Yeah, I tripped to New York with my little man, and I was blessed because my wife decided to come with me, which is great for this trip because any of the baseball people out there know that 12U is the last year on the little field before you go to the ginormous field, also known as a normal-sized baseball field. And so in the baseball world, 12U is the age at which everybody takes these like destination trips because they want to celebrate that last occasion. And so Wesley and I went to Cooperstown and had a great time there, but that's a tournament where they actually stay in the bunks with the other players. So it's a little bit like a baseball camp with games and beautiful scenery. Unfortunately, lots of weather, but had a great time. But Kristen came with me because I wasn't staying in the bunks with the boys, even though I'm one of the assistant coaches. I was like, I'm good. So Kristen and I got a place and it was not nearly as relaxing as it sounds because there was lots of baseball at all hours and manners of the night. But yeah, it was a good experience. I was glad Wesley got to do it. And any baseball people out there are very familiar with Cooperstown. It's a thing. Have you ever heard of that?
Oh, yeah. I grew up watching the utterly mediocre Pittsburgh Pirates, who I believe they have set the record for any professional sporting franchise in any of the major sports for the most consecutive seasons to not make the postseason, if I'm remembering correctly.
That's crazy.
And they traded Barry Bonds in like 1990. And it's basically been since then until the mid-teens or... There was one, like, they made a play-in game against the Reds. And so there's some question about, do we count this as, like, making the postseason? Anyway, definitely a baseball fan. And it sounds like a very cool experience. I look forward to perhaps doing that with my boys one day.
Yeah, got to visit the Hall of Fame. It was great. And Barry Bonds, interestingly, is not in there for reasons we will not discuss on the show because it's not a baseball show. Although I could wax and wane about that for quite some time. This show is, however, a listener question episode because I've had some questions being sent in to me. And as all of you listeners know, we like to answer those from time to time. So have a few episodes where we're going to answer some questions. And this one is interesting because these are questions that come up in like various phases of our life as physicians, right? So the first one's from a resident asking about whether to put extra money they have in residency towards their student loans. The second one is about an attending who's thinking about going part-time and the values behind that and the financial decisions behind that and how the math works. And the last one is a physician who has a kid that's now getting to college themselves and thinking about med school and asking about, hey, what should I be thinking about in terms of financing this for them? Should I finance this for them? And so this episode hits really lots of different stages of the physician journey in terms of different ages and demographics along the way. Before we dive in, longtime listeners, you obviously know that I believe disability insurance is the number one financial task for doctors. If your income stops, there's no money to invest or pay down debt or do any of the other things we talk about on this show. And so if you currently do not have disability insurance, particularly if you are in training, please make sure to check that box, get that done. The earlier you get it, the more options you have, the less expensive it is. And you can get a quote from us here at Money Meets Medicine Disability Insurance by going to moneymeetsmedicine.com/disability, where we would love to help you look into your options. So, Justin, why don't we take these in order and maybe why don't you read off the first one and we'll kind of take it from there.
Hey, Dr. Turner, my plan is to pay off my loans after training. So I am in the repayment assistance plan, also known as RAP. My payments are really low PGY1 and PGY2 year. If I have extra money, should I put it towards my student loans?
So I think this is a great question. And actually, this may seem like a new question, Justin, but I used to get the same question back when Save existed. I used to get the same question back when Repay, for those of you that are around.
RIP Repay.
I'm getting old now, right?
Yep.
The highest pay as you earn plan. And because all of these plans, all three of them had subsidies. And so people would say, hey, I'm thinking about paying off my loans. What do you think? And this was really common when I was in academics. I'd have residents just randomly ask me all sorts of questions about personal finance, which I do miss that aspect of academics, but this is a really, really common question. And obviously got to give credit to the person asking this because they're thinking about doing smart financial things with their money. So ultimately, if you're asking that question, you're winning just already. Let's maybe just start there. But to frame this, the easiest way to have this conversation is just to simply say, in all three of those programs, after you made your payment, some amount of the interest that was left was waived. It was basically forgiven. It was written off by the government. And so back in the repay days, it was 50%. And then now fast forward to the repayment assistance plan, and any remaining interest is waived. So 100% of it is waived. And so if you have this $10 monthly payment and you've got $1,000 in remaining interest, right? So should I put more money towards this situation? And most people asking this question in their mind, they're like, oh, it's just extra money to my loans. And so it's just going to pay it off faster. And what they don't realize is that extra money towards these loans often is eaten up by the interest waiver that you have. And so you put an extra $200 to it and you think that's going to go to principal. And they're like, no, that goes to your payment. And now you have $800 in interest that's going to be waived. Thank you for paying $200 for us. And so your effective interest rate, which was basically 1% or whatever that number was, 0.5% for you, is now 2% or 3% or whatever that math shakes it out to be. And so I just point that out as a general concept when you're asking these questions. It depends on which plan you're in. It depends if it has an interest subsidy. But what are your thoughts on this, Justin? I'm sure that you get asked this question occasionally too.
Yeah. So this is like a mini version of the PSLF opportunity, where if you think, okay, after 10 years, I can get PSLF, tax-free forgiveness for service in a public setting, community hospital, any qualifying 501c3, government, whatever. Should I, while I'm in attending, pay extra money as I go to get my balance lower and lower and lower? No, is the obvious answer when we frame it in this way, because the government is going to pay everything at the end of the line. So this is just sort of an annual version of this question, where the government is going to pitch in X number of dollars up to the total amount of interest for your year, roughly. And should you pay in addition towards that? You shouldn't, because there's a bunch of free money on the table each 12 months that the government is going to pitch in. That benefit gets reduced each calendar year to the extent of your contribution. So it's like, should you pay, or should the American taxpayer pay? It's like, on an individual basis.
Don't hate the player, hate the game. All right.
Yeah. Let's let the taxpayer pick up the tab on this, because that's how the law is written. So you always want to be aware of the interest subsidy and how it may be helping you during your training period in particular. Now, bigger picture, you want to know if you're going towards full repayment or forgiveness and optimize a strategy and across the different epochs of your earning. But for this listener, PGY 1 or 2, understanding how that subsidy works and not overpaying is going to be really important.
Yeah, some caveats I'll make here are that as your payment goes up, so say you get to your PGY 3, PGY 4, PGY 5 year, you've been in training for a while, and now that number that your payment's based on from your income is significantly higher, or you're married, or whatever your situation may be, obviously that subsidy gets smaller and smaller and smaller. Your payment goes up. And so this is really kind of key for those first couple of years in particular. As your situation advances, you need someone to take a look at your student loan situation and figure out what the right thing for you is. A corollary to this I often get asked, Justin, is, hey, should I refinance my loans? And so what I want to throw out here just very publicly is that once you privately refinance your student loans, public service loan forgiveness, that bridge is burned permanently. And so you should never, ever, under any circumstance, refinance your student loans, federal student loans, I should say, unless you are 100% certain you're not pursuing public service loan forgiveness. Like, once you know that, and I'm not talking like, oh, I think I'm going into private practice, I'm an intern. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking like you have a contract in hand, you know you're going into a place where PSLF's not an option, and there's no possible chance you could possibly move back and work back at an employer again that could have you do PSLF later down the line, because that happens, by the way, where doctors go to private practice for 2 years, they hate it, they come back to some 501c3 academic, governmental, state hospital, whatever, and then they could do PSLF again, and they've refinanced. And so refinancing is great. It lowers your interest rate if it's the right situation for you, but that is something that I just tell people all the time. Just make sure it's the right thing, that you've really done your homework on that to make sure that's your situation. Justin, question number two.
Hey, Jimmy and Justin. I'm 4 years out of training and things are going well financially. I want to drop to 4 days a week, but every time I run the numbers, I talk myself out of it. What does giving up one clinical day a week actually cost me over a career? And how do I know if I can afford it?
So I love this question for two reasons. One is that it's a values question.
Yes.
Two is that I went through this myself. So maybe I'll speak from personal experience on this one. So I went to 3 days a week. So anesthesia is not a 5 days a week specialty, right? So a typical job, you might be expected to work 200 shifts in a year. You do the math on that. In academics, I was probably somewhere around 4 days a week, give or take. And so I wanted to potentially go to 3 days a week, and doing the math on that, it was going to be about a 0.2 to 0.3% reduction in my FTE in order to get there. And part of the reason why I was burning out massively in medicine, I ended up on antidepressants and in therapy, and I was not in a good spot. And I was like, something has to change. And that was one of the things that I thought about changing to give myself more time to do some of those things, recover, become a human being again. And so I'm a math guy. I like money. So I ran the numbers and did the math. And, you know, let's just say that you're making 400 grand a year. You want to cut back 0.2 to get one day off a week. You normally work 5 days a week, right? That's an $80,000 number. And so the way that I thought through this was, okay, there's an $80,000 number that if I don't change anything else in my financial life, I now have to come up with or sort out or figure out in order for me to take that cut and not drastically change things for my family. And I think most people, when they come across that number, think, oh, well, I'm just going to have to spend less. And that's the only solution that they come up with, which is what forces them to go back and say, well, I'm not doing that. I'm going to go back to work and keep running myself into the ground. For me, I started thinking about it differently. I started thinking, okay, what are some ways that I can create $80,000 worth of value in the world outside of my clinical job in medicine that would allow me to make this change? What are some ways that I could spend less? That was a lever. What are some ways that I could potentially, if the numbers fit and I ran the numbers and how much do I need to save each year to retire by the age that I want? What if I save less every year, right? And that doesn't mean retiring less. That might mean retiring later. It might mean retiring unless. But there are so many financial levers to kind of consider there in terms of saving less and what that does to your retirement trajectory in terms of the number and in terms of the time, spending less, or alternatively making money outside of medicine so that you are doing something you have autonomy and control over in terms of schedule, if that's your thing, while affording that $80,000 pay cut in this $400,000 example. So part of it's a math thing, right? But the bigger part's the value part, which maybe, Justin, I'll let you speak towards because I know you have all those conversations all the time with physicians.
Yeah. One of the things that I have, I don't want to say changed my mind about, but where my perspective has shifted pretty meaningfully in the last handful of years is the sort of effective planning timeframe that any human can have for any life question. And I was actually talking with a prospective client last week, and I was talking about the sort of preliminary workup we're going to do for them. I'm like, all right, like in this workup, the client, prospective client says to me, I want to make sure that you show me like, what does it look like to retire at 60, 65, and 70? And I was like, just so you know, and this is somebody who, they were a physician spouse and their spouse is about to, I think, start attending hood right after fellowship. I was like, just so you know, I was in your shoes and I know that what you're saying feels like a thing that you should see, but there's actually no world in which that is going to be useful to you and it'll only be a distraction to the extent that you're actually thinking about, oh, what is the savings rate that gets me to a certain net worth at the age of 60? So we're not even going to do that. Like, let's talk about the next 3 years and how do we optimize that? Because that's really the effective planning horizon for all the things that you've got going on right now. You've got a kid, you've got a new job, you're moving, got student loans. You've got more than enough to think about. Let's optimize those variables. And so thinking in those terms is almost every time how I encourage people to start with this question. Also, because I'm married to an anesthesiologist, I have anesthesia publications show up on my front door, which usually I just throw them on the pile of last month's anesthesiologist.
That still haven't been read, most likely, I'm guessing.
But one of them caught my eye, the ASA monitor, just this past month, had an article. The title was The Rise of the Part-Time Anesthesiologists, which was funny to me because I was like, this has been happening for a while, actually. And looking at the academics interact with this phenomenon, kind of like they're looking at it like it's an animal in the zoo behind glass, and they're trying to describe it and understand it. And it's funny, you know, that I see a generational divide here. I see just the tone. And Jimmy, I'll send you the link so you can kind of see what I'm talking about. It was curious to me that we're speaking different languages here because I work with a lot of these 40, 45, 50-year-old doctors who are like, this is not weird to them. All their friends are doing it. And it's not just anesthesia either. There are a number of other specialties that often people reach out to an advisor because they're thinking, how do I taper the FTE? And this is a very important question. And often it is so driven by what's healthy for me right now. How much time do I want to spend with my kids? How's my relationship with my spouse? Do I want to have a hobby that my current clinical pace does not permit? None of those are like, what is my net worth at age 67? Questions. Those are all in this 12 to 24 month planning horizon. What should I do to make my life look the way that I want it to? And my bias is like, you might be dead by the time you're 67. So go ahead and do the thing today. Jimmy, I don't know about you, but I know zero anesthesiologists who are like looking for work and can't find it. If you went down to 0.5 and you're like, you know what, just kidding, I need to go back up to 0.8 so I can pay for my kid's college tuition. Like, I surmise you're going to find a place where that can happen.
Yeah. I mean, the markets always change, right? In terms of how flush the specialties are. And it's different for every specialty. I do want to go back to your comment because I think this is an important one to have a conversation about, because this has actually come up in my workplace, because we have people in the group that are older, a few years away from retirement, and we have people in the group that are younger. I'm a part-time guy, as you mentioned. So the rise of the part-time anesthesiologist, I'm part of that phenomenon. And it's just such interesting discussions, because I've heard this in so many different settings, in so many different hospitals, conversations, walks of life, conferences, you name it, where there's this belief that the reason that part-time anesthesiologists and, you know, part-time emergency medicine physicians, like just you name it, every specialty, that the reason that these people want to go part-time is because there's now this great divide in generational values, and that the younger generation just doesn't care as much about altruism and working hard and just being a part of this thing that's solving problems for humanity, like this hospital system that has these high values and is accomplishing so many great things for patients. And I find that to be such an interesting and uninformed opinion, to be honest with you. And I know it's going to be controversial even just amongst the listeners of the podcast, and maybe you can discuss it with your friends, but I'm never one to hold back any punches, as Justin knows. So here's the thing. Longtime listeners of Money Meets Medicine know that I don't recommend other businesses or services lightly. And that's because this entire platform was built out of my desire to prevent others from being harmed like I was by bad advice and bad actors in the financial space. This is one reason I say no to over 95% of pitches that I get for advertising and sponsorships on Money Meets Medicine. But some partnerships are no-brainers, like recommending the same company that I use in my own personal life. For example, working with Gelt for my tax strategy is set to save my family more than $40,000 per year in taxes compared to my old CPA, who only touched base in February or March each year. Gelt, on the other hand, is a proactive, tech-forward tax strategy company, and I could say, from experience, that their customer service is incredible. So if you're a locum stock or a practice owner, partner getting a K-1, surgery center owner, or maybe you're a W-2 physician with a 5 or 6 figure side income, you need more than a CPA who just checks in February or March. You need a modern CPA firm built for business owners and high earning professionals with a strong specialization in physicians. Summer is the easiest time to switch, and Gelt is built for that transition. Dedicated tax strategists, real human expertise, technology doing the grunt work in the background, to make it even more of a no-brainer than it already is for the docs that fit that bill. Money Meets Medicine has partnered with Gelt to offer a 10% discount on your first year services when working with them. Head over to moneymeetsmedicine.com/CPA to schedule a call and get that 10% discount when you do so. Now back to the show. Medicine in the 90s and in the 80s, and maybe even into the 2000s, but probably not 2000s, was very, very different. Right? The student loan burden that people came out with, vastly different compared to their income back then. The amount of compensation based on what things cost, the cost of living back then, was also vastly different. Remuneration in terms of compensation and what physicians could expect and the trajectory of it was very different back during those days, because insurance companies worked very differently, as did CMS. And so many things have changed on the financial side, even on the value side, right? The phrase that I heard for 4 years coaching burned out physicians was that they felt trapped in medicine, that they felt like a cog in the wheel, they felt like a number on a spreadsheet, that corporate medicine had taken over and was telling them how to practice medicine through, you know, either the insurance company side of things with peer-to-peer conversations and prior authorizations, or the EMR and what boxes they had to check. And being a doctor just didn't carry the same reverence and value and respect that it did in the 80s and 90s when these people had this intrinsic tie to their identity being part of being a physician in a hospital, where being a doctor meant something very different than what it means today. And so it's funny to me when the older generation expects the same kind of grunt work ethic, do things at all costs, no matter what it costs you personally, kind of mindset that they had, when the younger generation doesn't have the same respect, value, reverence for their position or the monetary pluses of the position that happened in the 80s and 90s. So I find this to be a, you know, hey, we're going to look at all these changes and the generations that are younger, they're built different. And I'm not saying that's not a part of it at all. Yes, younger doctors do actually want to be good parents and good partners and also be a good doctor. They don't have to choose between those three things. They think that's a false trichotomy, I guess would be the word for that.
Wow.
New words created on the fly. Yeah, that's a new one. You can keep that one. And so like there is some of that. There is a difference to some extent in values, but there's also been this massive change in medicine on the other side of things in terms of what is being provided to you in terms of respect and compensation that are very different, particularly in relation to the amount of debt that doctors now carry. And so I always find that to be such an interesting conversation. And even when people disagree with me on that take, I really enjoy having a conversation about what their thoughts are and why things are different. But I do want to point out one other thing, which is that you're talking about these like eras and epochs of life and the values changing as years go on. And as I've gotten older, I've just kind of realized that one of the things that I love doing is working. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean working in medicine. That might mean picking up shifts. It might not, but I like being productive. I'm a person who finds great satisfaction and reward from being productive. And so I kind of laugh now that I used to think, oh, what is the age by which I'm just going to cold turkey cut things off and retire, and have much more gone towards the view of, hey, what does my glide path look like where I'm doing more and more of the things that I want to do and less of the things that I don't want to have to do anymore? And how do I make that life come to fruition? And so like the math is now calculated based on, oh, well, I'm still going to have some income coming into my world based on these things that I know I'm going to continue to do, at least for the foreseeable future. And as those things change, I'll continue to reevaluate every 3, 4, 5 years, whatever it is. But this idea that like I was just going to cold turkey and all the money had to come from one source when I got to this one age is, for me, just not reflective of the life that I live and likely won't ever. My wife will tell you that I'm going to work until the day I die on something. So
I think I've told you the story, Jimmy, about sitting down with the financial planner who was offered to my wife and I through our 401k program at her practice. The first question that he asked is, all right, so tell me when you want to retire for our, you know, little consult, which it was just a funny question to have reflected back to me. And it was good reinforcement for me that this is never the right way to start this conversation. Mm-hmm. Especially for 30 somethings, but even in your 40s and 50s, instead of having this sort of like concrete idea of what the future is going to look like, it's all about often just creating options. And glide path is a great word. I want to be moving more and more and more towards my calendar being full of the things that I feel drawn to rather than stuff that I have to still deal with. And creating those future options is the job of good financial planning.
Yeah. And your life's going to change. Like 9 years from now, I won't have any kids in the house. Right. So I all of a sudden we'll have evenings and weekends back for the first time in a long time. And so I don't know, maybe I want to work more then. I have no idea, but things change. So I love the idea of having a target that's able to be manipulated and thought about more than just once. All right. Let's maybe question number three, Justin, let's move on to that one.
My daughter is applying to undergrad this cycle and she has an interest in going to medical school. I just found out grad plus loans are going away. We're going to pay for her undergrad, but now she's going to be limited to $200,000 in student loans. I paid for my own med school with federal loans, and I assumed she would do the same. How is she supposed to pay for this now, and how much should my wife and I be helping?
Yeah, so let's provide some context to this question just because there's a lot of information we obviously don't know from this. Let's say in this situation that this person paid for undergrad because that was part of their value system, and we'll talk about that here in a second in terms of figuring out, should you pay for your kid's college education? And if so, what are some things to consider? But let's say that undergrad's paid for. Let's say that they've now found out that the new One Big Beautiful Bill Act, I still can't say that word, is limiting grad school borrowing for physicians to $200,000 total. The average borrower, for those that don't know, for medical school is $200,000 and actually slightly above that now. And it's something like, last time I looked at the numbers, Justin, and these may not be the most recent, but in the last couple of years, it's like 40% of doctors that have more than $200,000 in student loans coming out of med school. And so let's also assume that this person is looking at the cost of attendance for potential medical schools and saying they're going to come out with 300. They're going to be in that 40% that's above $200,000, that federal borrowing limit now. And so what are my options, right? And I think this is a really interesting question because it's like a nuanced, new age, modern version of, should I pay for my kid's college education and or graduate school education? And I love these questions because everyone, like the spectrum is so wide and it varies amongst all of the people and all of the families. And so, you know, this mom's wanting to know, how do I make this work if that's what we're planning on doing? And she even says in there that I thought that if she went to med school, my daughter, that she'd take out federal debt, but now she can't do that. And so maybe I'll just start off by saying the obvious answer that most people historically would point out is like, when you run out of federal funding, you get private student loans. And so that's like the most common thing that's going to naturally pop into people's heads. many of you listening probably have private student loans based on your journey and trajectory, based on where you trained and how much money you could borrow and what the opportunities were in terms of borrowing from the school or federally or scholarships and that sort of thing. But maybe let's just start with the conversation about, should you save for your kids' college education? I want to start there, Justin, because I know you have these conversations. I know I do.
I've had hundreds of these conversations. It's not an exaggeration to say. And I had one recently that stuck in my brain as a little unusual because it was with the current, I did some consulting with Student Loan Planner. Hi, Travis. A few years ago when I was launching APM Wealth, and in that context had a lot of both like prospective, we're thinking about borrowing for the future, and we borrowed a bunch in the past, and how do we optimize the student loan repayment plan? And there's one conversation back then that sticks in my brain, which it was a multi-generational, there were three people on the phone. It was the student and then the parents, and there was some debt from the student and debt from the parents through Parent Plus loans, and we were trying to figure out like, how's this all gonna coalesce into some kind of cohesive strategy? And there was a lot of tears. There was a lot of regret expressed, a lot of like, oh my gosh, I shouldn't, my kid's working at Starbucks, they're living in my basement, they have a master's degree, you know, all the feelings that come with that. So there's that, and all the debt counseling experience that for better or worse shapes how I think about this. And then recently I had a conversation with a current client, husband and wife. We were together at a restaurant and with, you know, a client for the wealth management, because we know each other for years. And so I have a lot more context for those discussions other than parachuting in for 60 minutes and like put the puzzle together real fast. And this one was, we want our son to go wherever, the best school they can get to. We don't care how much it costs. And this was not a physician household. Frankly, like they can't afford to do that. It was a career change. A lot of things were delayed already. And I'm looking at this as the, you know, my calculator in my brain is sort of like starting to smoke and steam as I'm trying to think like, is this going to work? And I tried to push back. I was like, are you sure you mean everything? What if it's, you know, Harvard undergrad and Yale grad and it's out of state and they're looking at your income? There's not going to be need-based aid available. Maybe there's some merit in play, but we could be talking about a really large number. Are you sure? And they said, I have absolutely no doubt that this is precisely what we want. Education is everything for us. We want every option to be open for our kids. And this is so core that yes, I will work. I will drop dead in the OR at 82 if that's what it takes. And there is zero reservation. So that was great. I was like, awesome. Then the path forward is knowable and we can plan around that because this is so driven by values that we can just go for it.
So, but here's the thing. I know you and I have had this conversation in the past just about maybe helping people make the right decision. So I heard a story the other day of the surgeon who, maybe it was from that generation I was talking about before, earlier in the show, and loved doing surgery. But at some point in his career, got too old, and there were safety concerns. There were concerns about inefficiencies, that he was just getting too old and aged to successfully operate consistently on patients. And he didn't want to retire. He had no desire or design on retiring. And the hospital basically gave him the option, like, you can retire with some grace or we're going to have to terminate your contract because we don't want to do that. You've been here for decades. We want you to go out in style and respect and all the things that you deserve for working here for so long. And in the end, they basically ended up having to force him out. And then he went and worked at another hospital where they didn't let him do surgery, but he could like see some clinic patients, I guess. And for the next 10 years into his 70s, getting to 80, would tell the story for 10 years at lunch every day about how this hospital forced him out despite all the things that he'd done for the hospital. And so the thing that I think people miss in this context is, oh, I'm just going to work until the day I die. Well, that sounds great in theory, but unfortunately for most physicians, that's not an option. Like, you will get to an age. I know this for surgical specialties, procedural specialties. I know this for medical specialties. There was a pediatrician at Wake who used to come and give like emeritus grand rounds basically for the medical students. And he walked the halls of that institution until he was probably 90 years old and never wanted to leave, right? But he just kind of got to the age where it became obvious that maybe there were some memory concerns, maybe some mental capacity concerns. And so he couldn't take care of patients anymore. And so for me, I know you frame this the same way too sometimes, but for me, it's like, okay, so let's make sure we're looking at this appropriately, right? I want you really to understand this decision. And let's start with the fact, you absolutely can finance your education. You cannot, my friend, finance your retirement. And so if you are in that situation, you are forced to retire. You now don't have enough money because you chose to pay because of your values, your wonderful values, well-intentioned values, to pay for your kid's education. Your child now is going to be faced with the decision of paying for your living costs and healthcare costs in your elderly age at an age when they likely can't afford it. And so if you ask the child, hey, would you rather finance your education or pay for all of the things that will be required in my life when I'm in my 70s or 80s because I didn't save enough because I paid for your education myself. And that kid now has all this income earning potential that they could have paid back their debt themselves. But the older person, they don't have any more income earning potentials. That's not an option for them. And almost invariably, in my experience, the kid would be like, yeah, I want to pay for my loans. I want to take loans out or find other sources of it. And so when I have that conversation with friends that are very value-driven on paying for education, but I also know their age and I also know their financial situation because people share those things with me all the time, I kind of start asking those questions and just pointing out, hey, just some things to consider, right? And so now that's been framed appropriately so you understand really what the stakes are here. What are your thoughts on an in-state school? What are your thoughts on other options where you can still have the value of paying for your kid's education, but it not costing you the ability to retire and then your kid having to pay for your life in your 70s and 80s. And when it's framed that way, I find people are like, I guess that's a good point. I'm still valuing education by paying for it. But if I limited where they could go so that it wasn't the most expensive school in the world, if that's what they wanted to go to, like that's a reasonable thing to do. And by the way, just as an interesting fact, I looked up the average Harvard cost of attendance the other day because my kids are always curious about this stuff. And because of the massive endowment they have, it's actually not a very big number. So if you happen to get into Harvard, apparently that's actually not the most expensive proposition in the world. But we're Wake Forest fans, and I don't have an affiliation with Wake Forest anymore. So my son absolutely wants to go to Wake Forest someday, and that is going to cost a ridiculous sum of money. And there will be some hard and challenging conversations if Wesley or Grace, if she decides to go, they don't have scholarships, they don't have any financial aid, there's nothing there. It's like, hey, you've got this sum of money that we have saved. Because we chose to have kids early, it is not as much as it would have been if we'd chosen to have kids later. But we'll be alive for your grandkids and be able to help with them. So remember that. But we're not going to have $300,000 saved for all three kids. It's $1 million. I'm not doing that. I'm just not doing that. There are other ways to go to college without it costing $1 million.
Yeah. I think it was a handful of years ago, Vanderbilt was the first to eclipse the six-figure per year total cost of attendance for an undergraduate degree.
That's nuts.
Now, there are some undergraduate degrees at some institutions that definitely are worth that amount of money. But I don't know. Like I said, I'm just a product of my experience and I'm a product of those conversations with those crying families.
I get it. I really do. And so like, I'm not saying don't pay for kids' college education. We definitely plan to pay for some of it. But we've also made that clear to our kids. And I can speak about my own values that, hey, you're going to have X number of dollars available to you for your education. And so use that how you wish. I do hope that you consider some of our wisdom and counsel as your parents that God's put into your life to help provide those things to help make this decision. And if we need to make some changes or, you know, there's certain things we need to consider to expand the budget, we will do that. But so here are some options though for some concrete stuff, just to kind of round this out. Because the values conversation is really, really important. It's what guides everything. But in-state public versus private school, right? That is a big difference in a lot of states. There are often state programs that will pay for state schools. I know that when I grew up in Florida, that was the case. You had to have a certain ACT or SAT and GPA, and then you had a certain amount of your loans paid for, and you've got private loans, right? That's definitely an option. And if you're looking for lower interest rates on those, actually, I highly recommend you check out Juno. So you can go to moneymeetsmedicine.com/JUNO, because they have this group negotiation process that I think is actually really cool. It's like Costco for student loans. And so they are often able to find lower interest rates for people. So you should check out your situation if that's you. I'm curious on your thoughts on this, Justin, because I shared this off air before we started. But if I was in a situation where I'm burning through my kids 529 for that kid, this is the amount of money I have for each of them that I've decided is what we're going to do. And I still wanted to fund some extra money. I know for me, one of the places that I would look is in taking out a 401k loan, because that's basically money I'm taking out that I then quote unquote owe interest back on, but it goes back into my 401k. So I'm paying interest to myself. And so in some ways, it's kind of an interest-free loan because the interest that you're actually paying is going to you back into your 401k. It's not going to a bank or an institution. And now you obviously have to have the funds to be able to pay that back. There are terms and I'm sure there are fees and all sorts of things if you do not make your payments. But what are your thoughts on people tapping into a 401k for that sort of thing?
For my clients, when we're asking these kind of questions build a sort of liquidity hierarchy. Say like all the money, if you had an emergency and then another emergency and then another emergency and then another emergency and you just pile them and pile them, what's the order of operations in which we access the assets we have? And the 401k loan is one of those ones that's it's nestled above, in some cases.
I'd rather take that out than my HELOC.
Definitely above it. Yes, I agree. It's easy. There's no credit underwriting. It's pretty quick. It's capped at the lesser of 50% of your balance or $50,000. So up to 50 grand. If you only have 80 grand in your 401k, then you can get 40 grand, et cetera. The biggest problem with it, two problems. One is sort of the psychological, I now look at my retirement accounts as a piggy bank dynamic, which if you're disciplined, doesn't need to derail you forever, but that is a thing. The second problem is the opportunity cost. So sure, maybe it's only 7%. I'm paying the 7% to myself, but if it takes me 4 years to pay back and the S&P has been giving us 17% a year, the cost to you is actually way more than 7% that you're paying to yourself. It's that money not being invested for 4 years. So if you can deal with all that, I don't mind the 401k loan. And I have used 401k loans in the past for myself, and I sometimes recommend it to clients. Is it a good fit for education? Maybe.
And something I also want to point out is just around the South. We talked about 401k loans. We talked about private loans. We've talked about, obviously, you saving for your kids. The 529 has been exhausted in this example, so I wasn't really including that there. But obviously, there's some ways that you can save up for it. In-state school, I should say, potentially cheaper. And then, of course, there's other things like HPSP, service to military stuff, and that brings in a whole other set of values and conversations. But there are other ways to pay for education that don't involve the student necessarily paying. And then there are state forgiveness programs. So I know in North Carolina, there's the FELS program, F-E-L-S, you know, forgivable loan program in North Carolina, which I've had residents count their quote-unquote service as part of their residency once they got their full state license, and it started counting towards the years they owed back to get that money. So there are state options, there are federal options, there are military options, there are, of course, scholarship options if those are available, in addition to all of the other things we discussed. So just know that there are lots of different ways to go about solving this problem. But if you really do get down to like brass tacks and it's like, hey, saving for retirement versus saving for my kid's education, like I highly encourage you to go have that out with an advisor that knows your situation, knows your numbers, can talk realistically through what you're actually going to be doing to yourself if you do one versus the other. And ideally, you're in a situation where you can retire by an age that you think is reasonable and pay for the education if that's part of your value system. But if it's not, man, I'd hate to make that decision by myself. I'd want a professional helping me.
Two final things.
Yep.
Number one is I find that the sort of the regret test is useful here. So I'm thinking about that conversation that I had with the husband and wife, and the way that you articulated it, Jimmy, I think is really helpful to say, okay, we're going to have both of these paths articulated and go wrong. Which one, in the way that it goes wrong, is worse? And if it's really, really, really bad, if option B goes wrong, then maybe option A is kind of a good default path just because B is so bad. And in this case, it might be you have a disability event when you're 52 and you never saved and you paid for expensive undergrad, expensive grad for your firstborn. And maybe there's a couple other kids behind that. And all of a sudden, the faucet gets turned off for your income. And now you're in your kid's basement. Maybe their income is in flux. That's how that one breaks, so to speak. How does that feel compared to the other way, which is my kid did 2 years at community and then 2 years at state and then had to take the path of a little more scrappy, feisty DIY in order to achieve the med school dream. Or maybe they can't get into med school or when that goes wrong. But perhaps in that case, you're not living in the basement. Is one of those really, really worse than the other? And so thinking about it in those terms can be a helpful stress test. And secondly, you got to do this before your kid is 18. These questions you got to ask when they're born or when they're 2 or 4 or 6, because the horse is kind of out of the barn. You can still optimize a little bit, but the best plans for education savings are best initiated when your kids are quite young. So anybody out there who's listening thinking this is so abstract, it's way in the future, actually today is the time when you should be laying the groundwork.
I couldn't agree more. As someone who had kids young and couldn't save for the first 7 or 8 years of their life, it has been extremely challenging to catch up. We will not catch up, to be honest with you, based on our situation. So I couldn't agree with that more. As we head out, if all this stuff seems super complicated to you, from student loans and savings and investing and the whole nine yards, make sure to go snag a free copy of The Physician Philosopher's Guide to Personal Finance. You can do that at moneymeetsmedicine.com/freebook. If you haven't gotten your disability insurance and you're in training, please go get a quote from us from Money Meets Medicine Insurance at moneymeetsmedicine.com/disability. Super important to look into your options and make it affordable, even on your residence budget. All right, everybody. We'll see you next week. Cheers. Justin Harvey is a certified financial planner at APM Wealth, where he helps anesthesiologists and pain medicine physicians. Dr. Jimmy Turner is a practicing academic anesthesiologist at Wake Forest in North Carolina. He's also a licensed insurance agent. However, either Justin or Jimmy are your financial planner, investment advisor, or insurance agent. This show is expressly for general education and entertainment purposes only. Nothing should be considered financial advice. All views expressed are solely the views of the guests on the show and do not represent the views or opinions of their employer. Justin Harvey is a certified financial planner at APM Wealth, where he provides financial advisory services for physicians and their families. Dr. Jimmy Turner is a practicing anesthesiologist in North Carolina and a licensed insurance agent. However, neither Justin nor Jimmy is your financial planner, investment advisor, or insurance agent, and nothing discussed on this show creates that kind of relationship. This show is expressly for general education and entertainment purposes only, and nothing should be considered financial, investment, insurance, tax, or legal advice. The views expressed by the hosts and any guests are solely their own and do not represent the views or opinions of their employers, and their appearance on the show does not constitute an endorsement of their services. Before making any financial decisions, of course, consult your own financial, tax, or legal professional who understands your individual situation.